Well, my topic today was going to be war and peace, not a book report, but about the issues of war and peace. But I started to do some research, and I realized that war is no longer a problem, so I really have nothing to say. We have not fought a war since World War II. That was the last declared war that the United States fought in. Korea was not a war. Vietnam was not a war. Going into Cambodia, wow, those were not wars. Grenada was not a war. Intervention in the Balkans was not a war. Going in to some areas of Lebanon didn't involve war. The first Gulf War obviously was mislabeled and couldn't have been a war because there was no war declared. And the second Gulf War is obviously also false advertising. So it should be clear to all of us that the Kellogg-Briand Pact that outlawed war back in the late 1920s was successful, with the one exception of World War II, slight exception, probably really not more than, you know, 50, 60, 70 million people killed. But that was the exception. Other than that, obviously outlawing war has worked tremendously. And so there's really nothing to talk about today, which I'll explain later what that means. Look, war is clearly one of the greatest defining issues of any and all time. We are constantly involved in wars all across the world, whether we are involved actively as participants, fighting and dying, actively as puppet masters, arming and encouraging and training, or inactively just selling to whoever has the money to buy the arms. Being part of the dozens of wars and rebellions and insurrections that are going on around the world is inescapable, whether as an active participant or a spectator. You can't help when you sing the words to the hymn that we just sang about the years are speeding, when we're going to give all this stuff up, when we're going to furl the banners, when we're going to turn our swords into plowshares, our spears into pruning hooks. And that song was written, he lived from 1803 to 1890. We still don't seem to have a handle on this giving up war thing. And it's not just a hobby anymore. War is pretty serious, universal, across the world, important. Because while people always fought and died in wars, whether justly or unjustly, civilians always died in wars, whether by design or by happenstance. Today, war is a threat to the entire world. That in a time when, long ago, when people were throwing rocks across rivers, war had one set of consequences. When you started getting guns, it changed the nature and the danger of war. And then cannons, and then airplanes, and then bombs, and then nuclear weapons. And the consequences of war have dramatically changed. Since the last real official war that the United States fought and ended with the dropping of two atomic bombs, one on Hiroshima and one on Nagasaki, the Soviet Union, now out of business and having a going out of business fire sale with its nuclear weapons, became a nuclear power. China became a nuclear power. Most terrifyingly of all, France became a nuclear power. That's just so I don't look too liberal. Because, you know, when you combine nuclear weapons and red wine, it really makes it that much more dangerous. South Africa probably became a nuclear power, but probably also gave up the program. Israel became a nuclear power. India, Pakistan, and maybe North Korea there's a clear trend and a clear and present danger that people want nuclear weapons. For street cred, it's what makes you real and powerful in the world, and you get a certain kind of respect. So everything in our policy, and by ours I don't simply mean the United States, everything in the world's policies are designed for countries and movements to want to get the respect that they believe they will get from having nuclear weapons. This makes war really scary, because the more people that have these, the more dangerous our world becomes. Now, I know, when I was at the university and studying international relations and taking my arms control classes, which I, in fact, did, the basic theory of arms control was that atomic weapons don't kill people, people kill people. I think the NRA had given some funding grant to the USC School of International Relations for that to have been the essential core curriculum. Weapons, and the example was kind of interesting, which was, we don't have to have disarmament treaties between the United States and Canada. Our weapons are much closer to Canada, but the Canadians don't feel threatened by our nuclear weapons. They only feel threatened by our culture, our television, and our conventional weapons that get smuggled across the border. So there's a little bit of truth to that. But the bottom line is that the more powers that have nuclear weapons, and the more our world equates having nuclear weapons with respect, the more dangerous our world becomes. And our world is pretty dangerous as it is. One of the most dangerous things, and yes, I'm going to talk about the Iraq War, so you know, don't wonder if I'm going to get to it. I'm going to get to it now. Of the many conflicts we're involved in, Iraq is obviously central in most people's minds. It is at least the defining and presenting problem and issue for the United States. Most of us probably have fairly hardened positions on the war. And I want to tell you that what I am going to attempt to do in the next 8 paragraphs is just to shake up some of our hardened positions. I teach a course on understanding the Middle East at the university, and I promise people that a result of taking this class will not be that they understand the Middle East. This at least is a promise I can keep. But they will understand all of the moving parts, all of the conflicts of tribe, of ethnicity, of religion, denomination, and history that go into making it what an incredible and unpredictable mess that it is. And it has been my position, I've shared this with this congregation, that if you believe you understand the Middle East, if you are really sure that you know what is going to happen, if you have the idea that if only these fools would do this, everything would be fine, rethink your position. Because the Middle East calls for knowledge, curiosity, flexibility, and most importantly, and the most difficult of all the great religious values, humility. I do not have easy answers, but I know that our hardened positions can sometimes be only apparently a hardened position. Let me tell you what I mean. Most of us could not imagine being on the other side from the side that we are on. And let me make a couple of generalizations. In general, people of a liberal persuasion think that Iraq is a terrible mess, that we are involved in a civil war where we do not understand the moving parts, Sunnis and Shias and Kurds, oh my, what are we going to do? That we don't know how to fix them, we don't understand their history, the history of tribalism, of ethnicities. Some of the fights and arguments are actually go back before the birth of the prophet. And some of them are narrow, sectarian, and non-tribal, and are denominational disputes every bit as difficult and as violent as the religious wars in Europe during the Reformation. And that the liberal position is get out of there because we are only breeding another generation who will hate us and who will kill us. And the more of them we kill, the more of them are going to be interested in killing us for the next century or so. The liberal position is essentially true. The conservative position is usually a variation of stay the course or correct the course in order to have success, because the Middle East punishes failure and punishes weakness. That in the Middle East, the viewpoint of socially about violence is very much like spousal abuse. If you tolerate it, it will escalate. If you show weakness, you will become victimized again and again. If the United States turns its back and walks away, there will be horrifying chaos, and people will be killing each other in far greater numbers than they are killing each other today, and it will be an absolute horror. That the Kurds will want independence on the north, the Turks will want to take the Kurdish oil fields at Kirkuk, the Kurds and the Arabs will be fighting each other even as they are right now, the Sunni and the Shia will keep their existential struggle for, by existential I mean for life. The Sunni understand that they cannot surrender to the Shia or they will die. The Shia understand that they cannot surrender to the Sunni or they will die. And so the conservative position is essentially, if you get out of there, it will make a worse mess in the entire world. And they're right also. That's also true. So if I'm right, and I think both of them are right, shouldn't this lead to a little bit of humility, a little bit of hearing and understanding each other's positions and working reasonably, not with sound bites, but with real thought and a sense of just how difficult and complex these societies and these histories are in order to find what it is that we can either most productively, if you're an optimist, or least destructively do to bring down the killing and the dying, to preserve our dignity and our children and our children's children and our broken military. Most of us cannot imagine switching sides in the great debate and arguments going on about Iraq. But let me present to you for your consideration, and usually this works if you can be funny about it, because the reason to use humor, by the way, is that it bypasses all of the censors and the preconceptions, and if you laugh, you have to kind of deal with the fact that it got to you. Reasoned argument is always at a disadvantage, which is why we generally shout. And I can't make this part funny. So let me try reasoned argument without shouting. I can imagine liberals and conservatives changing sides on this. Think for a moment that the liberal position, for the most part, is classically based in other parts of the world on issues of humanitarian and compassionate concerns. It was liberals who argued most strongly for an early intervention into Bosnia for humanitarian reasons. Liberals who argued very strongly for an intervention into Rwanda and Somalia, who feel terrible guilt and frustration at the horrors of what's being perpetrated in Darfur. The liberal position is you cannot stand by when people are slaughtering each other and there's a humanitarian need. The conservative position is, you know, if it's not our business and if it's not our civil war, And if there are no compelling national security interests, just mind your own business, because we're not in the business of nation building. And stay out of that, because you need to stay out of it, because you can't fix their problem. Their arguments are older than we are older than the United States is, and go back centuries, if not millennia. Well, yeah, there's some truth to this too. I could very well imagine sides being reversed if only something different had happened. All men being mortal, and women too, I'm told, Saddam Hussein would have died, either of natural causes or somebody would have helped him to paradise at some point. At some point, when he tried to hand over power to his two charming children, the handoff likely would have been fumbled. And as would happen with the death of Marshal Tito in the former Yugoslavia, all hell would probably have broken loose at some point. And at some point, the Kurds would have wanted independence, the Turks would have wanted to prevent it, the Sunni would be fighting for their lives, and the Shia would be fighting for revenge, and the Iranians would be fighting for hegemony, and the Saudis would be fighting to aid the Sunni, and we would have one hell of a mess, not unlike the hell of a mess we have today. Except, probably, liberals would be saying, you got to get in there and keep the parties apart, and conservatives would be saying, you got to stay out of there because it's a civil war, it's nation building, you can't teach these people anything, and we would have changed sides. Moral positions, or apparently hard moral positions, are often built on the slender reed of the happenstance of first causes. We replace Saddam and one set of moral consequences. Saddam is replaced by others and another set of moral consequences. Now, I'm taking the coward's way out. I'm not giving you an answer here. We're about to have a pledge campaign, and I'm not stupid enough to try to give you a moral answer for what you pledge. You need to pledge a full 10% to have the answers to the great philosophical and moral questions, to have that kind of authority coming from the pulpit, and I don't even have a pulpit. But this is simply a thought problem for us to look at the assumptions that we make and try to understand the complexities of the situation and what often motivates people who seem to have nothing in common with us. Now, I think that this is the single most important issue in front of us, but obviously I'm wrong, because intelligent discussion and even unintelligent discussion of this was interrupted constantly in the last 2 weeks by the diaper astronaut Anna Nicole Smith. And I really feel terrible about it. I'm the only person without a plausible claim to paternity. Even my wife was embarrassed that I didn't put in an affidavit of some sort. And of course, Britney Spears having her head shaved. And so the question becomes, what the hell is wrong with us? And I actually want to give a kind of brief, serious analysis. It's absolutely explicable. What I just went over in terms of the Middle East and just the issues immediately around Iraq and the moral strategic complexities and the ethical complexities of this are, by definition, complex and difficult and unsure and hard to get your mind around. And my position is, if you're too sure, you really ought to reevaluate. But when somebody tells you about a diapered astronaut driving 900 miles because of jealousy, we know what jealousy is. We know what humiliation is. We can get our minds around all of this. When somebody talks about the meteoric, if tragic, if pathetic, arc of Anna Nicole Smith Marshall, maybe Stern, maybe not Stern, we understand there's an archetypal story here, from nothing to the appearance of something and back to nothing. And we're so smart we could predict it. Not only do we understand it, not only can we relate to it, but because we've seen the story archetypally before, we can predict it, which makes us feel smart and in control of the situation. So would you rather be wrestling with the moral complexities and be unsure of the great issues of life and death, or do you want to be sure about something even if it has no meaning at all? Which absolutely explains the news, and absolutely explains why I fell apart laughing when Christina gave the introduction from Channel Everything. We know you have other worship choices that you can make, and we thank you so much for choosing us. And that's what it's about. For Unitarian Universalists, I'm not kidding, we don't give easy answers. We don't give easy answers to quote Garrison, to life's perplexing problems. We invite study and thought and conversation and reasoned, respectful argument with some degree of open ears and open minds and open hearts, so that we can hear one another and learn and grow and come to understand. Just like deals, if they're too good to be true, they are too good to be true. If it's too simple to understand, probably either it's not important or we don't understand it. Doubt is the handmaiden of truth. And humility, in my view, is the hardest of the religious values to practice, because it's so much easier to be sure. And I miss the days when I had 20/20 moral clarity. I miss the days when I knew everything, when I wasn't filled with questions, and it leads us to great problems, because we do have to act in the world. We do have to make choices in the world. Whether we are involved in a humanitarian conflict as a referee or in a war, these are important life and death for us, our children, and even our world questions that we approach best when we approach with openness and humility. And it's hard to do, and it's hard for me to do it every day, because I have got the news implant and care deeply about all of these things, and I have to come down personally on one side or another. But even when I choose, it is also with a sense of openness and respect to the ideas and to the passions and to the values, often values that I share with others who differ. This is the model that as Unitarian Universalists we try to create, which is a community that not simply tolerates diversity but feels enriched by diversity, as long as the diversity is conditioned with candor and kindness. And everything that I've seen of this congregation makes me believe that these conditions exist for us. Amen.